This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Stem cell research and outright fraud. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Korean scientist Wang Woo-suk really did clone Snuppy the puppy, but his claim of creating stem cells from human patients turned out to be faked. America's Catholic bishops are among those now ridiculing stem cell research itself as the chasing of miracle cures for the most feared diseases. On To the Point, we'll hear what the Korean disaster could mean for medical science in the United States. We'll talk to a British researcher who wants to implant human cells in the embryos of rabbits. We'll hear objections to stem cell research from a scientific perspective. On Reporter's Notebook later on, the controversial legacy of Martin Luther King. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Mormon Olney, back with To the Point. A Korean scientist's admission that his work was faked is a black eye for stem cell research. On To the Point, why did it take 20 months to expose the fraud? What about promises of medical breakthroughs? Will support for stem cell research continue both here and in the rest of the world? On Reporter's Notebook, it's Martin Luther King Day, but there is still dispute about how he should be remembered and how his ideas should be applied. We'll hear about that. First, this news update. Republican Senator John McCain is among American leaders saying that military action against Iran should not be ruled out in the aftermath of Iran's defiant resumption of research that could lead to development of a nuclear weapon. In London today, officials from Britain, France, and Germany joined the U.S. in pressing Russia and China to see the matter referred to the U.N. Security Council. Anton LaGuardia is diplomatic editor of London's Daily Telegraph. Anton, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Understand that there has now been set a special meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency Board of Directors, moved up to February. How significant is that?
Well, it is the first step in what is likely to be a long diplomatic campaign against Iran. The board meeting is set for February the 2nd, at which the Western countries, if you want, the Americans, the Europeans, the Japanese, and some of their allies will push the board to report Iran to the Security Council. The question really is not whether they can do it or not. They have the votes to do it, but the question is how united a front are they going to get? And that meeting in London today was really about trying to get the Russians and the Chinese either to support them or at least not to oppose them.
In Moscow, then, after meeting with the new chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, Mr. Putin had something to say about this. What can you tell us?
Well, he said that the Russians, who had blocked, incidentally, a similar move to report Iran to the Security Council in September, he said that they were very close to the Europeans and the Americans. So that is good news for those countries. The bad news, I suppose, is that he says you must be very careful, you must make no mistakes, by the way, the Iranians still want to talk. That is something that, at least if you listen to Condoleezza Rice on her way to Liberia, says the time for talking is over, they must go to the Security Council. Any further delay will merely allow the Iranians to throw up, as she put it, chaff.
And what Mr. Putin says the Iranians want to talk about is the idea of enriching uranium on Russian soil, then moving the enriched uranium to Iran, so presumably they wouldn't be doing it themselves and learning how to make nuclear weapons.
Precisely. The diplomatic fudge is to have a joint venture, a Russian-Iranian joint venture, not in Iran, but in Russia, where the Russians would have control over all the key technical aspects, and the Iranians would nominally share ownership. The Iranians until now have said they're not interested in that idea, while the Americans and the Europeans have said, if it works, it's fine by us.
Anton LaGuardia, once again, is diplomatic editor for the Daily Telegraph in London. Mohammed Al-Baradei, who's the executive director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, a Nobel Prize winner, of course, was very outspoken about Iran recently in Newsweek magazine. How significant are his statements?
Well, this is a man who has been extremely cautious throughout these past two or three years of inspections of Iran, and he's always given the Iranians the benefit of the doubt. He's always come out with reports that said, we haven't got all we want from them, but we're making progress. And now he tells Newsweek, basically, the time for talking is almost over. You've got until March the 6th. If not, I will have to tell the world that I can't guarantee that your nuclear program is entirely peaceful. And he even talks about the possibility of sanctions and even economic or even military action. This is really unprecedented stuff from Mohammed al-Baradei.
What sort of military action might be possible if, in fact, the Iranians aren't able to satisfy the UN Security Council?
Well, the first question you have to ask is whether the Security Council would ever sanction military action or whether a country or several countries would act unilaterally, in which case we're back to the Iraq scenario. The second problem is that Iran's nuclear facilities are widely dispersed. Some of them are buried deep underground. So it would be very difficult to destroy the whole program. So there's no OSIRAC option, if you want. There's no one-shot option like the Israelis carried out against Iraq's nuclear reactor in 1981. So the question for anyone considering military action would be, what would it achieve and what would be the cost? How would the Iranians retaliate? And at a time when the Americans and the British certainly are in difficulties in Iraq, that is a difficult one to call.
What, in the meantime, have the Iranians been saying about either sanctions or the possibility of military action? Do they seem to take those things seriously?
They do. They profess not to be worried about it. They say that if we report to the Security Council, we will immediately cut back all our voluntary cooperation with the IAEA, so no snap inspections, and full resumption of the enrichment program. So they're threatening to escalate and to remove our eyes and ears, or some of our eyes and ears, on what they're doing. Secondly, they've also talked about the possibility of oil prices going up. They phrased it in terms of this being inevitable outcome of a crisis in the Gulf, but in practice, everyone knows what that threat means. Finally, in the past, you have heard Iranian commanders saying that if we are attacked, we will respond in every way that we deem possible. So you have to think of Iraq, you have to think of activating Hezbollah in Lebanon, you have to think of the possibility of the closure of the Straits of Hormuz, you've got to think of the possibility of the Iranian supporting terrorist acts against Western targets the world. But that's the kind of nuclear option, if you want, at the end of it all.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Anton LaGuardia, diplomatic editor for the Daily Telegraph newspaper in London. We'll, of course, follow that, starting with the meeting of the Atomic Energy Agency in February. In a moment, we'll be talking about stem cell research and outright fraud on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're now back with To the Point. The admission of fraud by Korean scientist Hwang Woo-suk may or may not have cast doubt on predictions that stem cell research might lead to treatments or cures of human diseases. It has cast doubt on the credibility of Science magazine, which published his claim to have created human embryonic stem cells from patients. In yesterday's New York Times, Nicholas Wade wrote that because of the magazine's authority, Wang's claims were picked up by newspapers and prominently reported and presented to the public as if they were important breakthroughs. Dr. Donald Kennedy is the former president of Stanford University, current editor of Science. Dr. Kennedy, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
This fraud, which was ultimately published by you, certainly created expectations, and it wasn't corrected for 20 months. What happened?
First of all, it was very carefully reviewed by peer reviewers who know this science very well. It impressed them and has impressed everybody else since as being a fully credible and very, very interesting finding. That it is fraudulent is, of course, a terrible disappointment to us at Science and to the scientific community. But the fact of the matter is that review processes, even in very good journals, and we think we have one, don't guarantee the infallibility of a result.
Does this have something to do with the distinction? And I go back again to the story written yesterday by Nicholas Wade, which we don't have time to review for our listeners, but he made a distinction between frontier science and mainstream science. What's that distinction and how important is it in this case?
Well, I can't read Nick Wade's mind, but he's a good journalist, and I think what he means is that mainstream science produces results that are sort of expected under conventional wisdom, that aren't big surprises, but that advance the field somewhat. I think what he's referring to in the Huang case is a discovery that appears to plow a new furrow, to take a science to a place where it hasn't been before, because nobody thought before Huang's success that there weren't special difficulties in the way of doing somatic cell nuclear transfer into a human ovum.
So when you say then that this is something that has never been contemplated before or never been developed before, is that one of the very reasons why it's difficult to review the experimentation and the research?
Well, it isn't exactly true that it hadn't been contemplated before. In fact, a lot of people had been trying it and had looked as though they might succeed but hadn't succeeded. So I don't think it was difficult getting a very thoroughly professionally competent review. The trouble is that the experiment as it was described and the technique that Huang appeared to have brought to this business was so impressive and so convincing that nobody doubted it.
Well, again, then, how should we view, we lay people, and particularly lay journalists, view a situation like this? If your magazine publishes something that appears to be as forward-looking and as important to break through as it is, how should it be reported, except as that?
Well, I think you report it as a very interesting finding that appears to have passed a very careful scrutiny. But remind people that science isn't truth until it gets repeated. That is independently verified by somebody else doing the experiment.
Do magazines like yours, and yours is almost unique, but Science Magazine has enormous authority. Is that part of your responsibility as well?
You bet it is. And I think one of the things, obviously, that we're going to be doing is a careful review of our procedures and so forth. This is a particularly complicated case over there because there were several institutions and over two dozen investigators who were involved at one level or another, and we're still not going to know exactly who did what until some investigations over there get completed. But we want to figure out ways in which we can, A, provide researchers with a real disincentive for this sort of thing, and second, to be a little bit more careful about the way we report exciting new things, even where they appear entirely credible.
What are the incentives for fraud?
Oh, that's so difficult to say. Some think that commercial opportunity, the possibility for patents, might be an incentive. My own judgment is a little different. Scientists work in a highly competitive prestige economy. They compete avidly with one another for recognition, for tenure if they're in academic institutions. And so there's a lot of incentive to do well. Now, in the hands of 99.9% of scientists, that means putting in a little extra effort, getting one more postdoctoral fellow in the lab and so forth. But occasionally it results in a desire to make something up.
So do you think that this is likely to happen again? Is there that possibility? Is there any way to make absolutely certain, whether you're Science Magazine or anybody else?
It's happened three times in my six-year career as editor-in-chief of Science. In one of those cases, the fraud involved a very well-praised series of physics articles from Bell Laboratories, of all places. And it turned out that one person who had a particular technique that was essential to all of them had committed fraud. And that involved the retraction of papers in three different journals, a total of maybe 15 of them. So it can happen, and there are people out there who are good enough scientists to make a credible case and ethically dicey enough to want to bring off a fraud.
All right. We all hope it won't happen again. Meantime, thanks very much for being with us, being so candid about it today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Donald Kennedy, again, editor-in-chief of Science Magazine, which published the fraudulent research involving the cloning of cells. Professor Chris Shaw is professor of neurology and neurogenetics at King's College London. He, with one of his colleagues, who in fact cloned Dolly the sheep, has made an application in England for a very special kind of research. And Professor Shaw, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Your research has been described as follows, as trying to implant human cells in the embryos of rabbits. First, I need to ask you, is that an accurate description of it? And secondly, why do you want to do it?
That's not a completely accurate description. We have at the moment a license in the UK to use eggs that have failed to fertilize during in vitro fertilization to undertake these nuclear transfer experiments. And our proposal is to use the cells, the embryonic stem cells derived from these embryos, to study disease processes. In this case, it's a disease known as amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, also known in the U.S. as Lou Gehrig's disease. The idea of nuclear transfer here is to take cells, usually skin cells, from a patient who has a genetic form of the disease, but in whom we don't actually know what the gene defect is. So if you like, it's a skin cell, programmed to be a skin cell, that we can put inside an egg that's had its own genetic material removed to try and reprogram that nucleus. Now, that nucleus will contain all the sort of normal genes, but it'll also contain a gene that is mutated such that motor neurons will degenerate. The idea there is to develop an embryo and extract embryonic stem cells from that we can then drive to become motor neurons in the laboratory. So we're not making in any way organs or tissues or a being. We're just generating cell lines. And these cell lines, we hope, will tell us something about the disease process that is ALS and also perhaps give us a cellular model to look for compounds that might reverse that process. So that's where we were up to until about 6 months ago. We have a license to do this. We're wanting to use human oocytes, and we've been in discussion and indeed visited Huang's laboratory on two occasions. And the impression we got from Huang's work is that perhaps with 10 to 20 human eggs, we might generate a single cell line, which would be a great breakthrough. The problem we have now is that we discover that Huang has had perhaps over 2,000 eggs and has yet to generate a single successful embryonic stem cell line. So the task for us is very much harder. Nobody's achieved this before. That obviously makes it a greater prize, but it could be a very long time before we actually develop any stem cell lines to work with.
Where do the rabbits come in?
Well, the rabbits come in as an alternative. The fertility of rabbits is legendary. We believe we can obtain oocytes from them. And indeed, there has been a work in Shanghai by a woman called Shang, who has successfully transferred the skin cell from a human individual into an egg from a rabbit and generated stem cell lines from it. So the reason to go to rabbits is not just that we're stuck on rabbits, it's just that it's been done before. And this was work that was published in 2003. That work needs to be repeated, obviously, but it has undergone peer review and quite close scrutiny. And I think that is an opportunity. The rate-limiting step at the moment is going to be the availability of human eggs. And, of course, the ethical concerns about stimulating women and deriving these eggs.
What do you think the current controversy about the research in Korea will do to your request to be allowed to conduct this research?
Well, I think it's difficult. We have an application at the moment to allow women to altruistically donate eggs. That is, women who want to support the science. For whatever reason, perhaps they have a family member who's been affected by ALS, they are prepared to undergo the stimulation and the egg retrieval so that they can help us, you know, develop cures for this dreadful disease. Now, I think it's going to be hard for them to comfortably do that, or it's going to be harder for them to do that now that this egg donation has been associated with fraud and fraudulent science. Plus, you know, we could have told them before that with one or two women donating, we had a good chance to develop a stem cell line. Now we have to say, well, we don't know whether we will be able to generate a stem cell line. It may take many donors and many eggs. So it's very difficult to give people a sort of positive message about the outcome of this work in a relatively short time frame.
So you think, then, that this just gives you a leg up in terms of your application to use rabbits for the process instead of rabbit eggs instead of human eggs?
Well, no, we've been considering animal-based egg transfer for quite some time. And, you know, it's a logical alternative. I have to say that our thoughts about it have been stimulated more by the latest revelations. But, you know, this is something that's a well-recognized and sensible approach. It was always going to be the case that human eggs were going to be the rate-limiting step, and of course there are the ethical and practical concerns about the woman's health that need to be considered. So I think the animal option is important. Of course, there are the concerns about there being species differences and what effect they might have, so we're still very much interested in developing the human oocyte nuclear transfer technique. That is still a goal, but I think we need to develop a parallel set of experiments that involve animal eggs, and in particular, the rabbit seems a likely candidate.
Again, Chris Shaw, professor of neurology and neurogenics at King's College in London. Just again, for purposes of reference, his partner in this matter is the one who, in fact, cloned Dolly the sheep, a very famous moment in genetic development. Ruth Hubbard is professor emeritus of biology at Harvard University. She's also founder and emeritus board member of the Council for Responsible Genetics. She speaks on this program for neither of those institutions, but for herself. Professor Hubbard, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
I understand that you have problems of the sort that Chris Shaw just referred to with regard to the risk to human women in the production of cells, eggs rather, for these purposes. How do you feel about the application involving rabbits?
Well, I think going to animals is the logical way to go. I am very concerned, as you say, about the use of women to get large numbers of eggs or indeed small numbers of eggs. I mean, if one can work with embryos left over in fertility clinics, that's one thing. But if you have to collect eggs for research, I and my colleagues at the Council for Responsible Genetics feel extremely touchy about that, because it's not risk-free, as Dr. Shaw said. Now, the other thing that I think is important from his remarks is that in UK, this research is government-sponsored, and as he kept saying, they work under license from the government. In the United States, and I don't know what the situation is in Korea, but in the United States, there are severe government restrictions, in fact, on obtaining embryos because of regulations by the president and the Congress, which means that the majority of the work, almost the entire work, is privately funded. It is in no way licensed or supervised by the government, and it is all market-driven and highly individualized.
I'm going to interrupt you for a moment. We need to take a very brief break. We will do that. We will come back and talk further with Ruth Hubbard and Chris Shaw and others about the issue of genetic engineering, as it's often called, and stem cell research in particular. On Reporter's Notebook, the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King on PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Onley back with To the Point, talking today about the aftermath of revelations that there was fraudulent research reported by Science Magazine to the effect that a Korean scientist had created stem cells from human patients. All that, again, turned out to be faked. We've spoken with Professor Chris Shaw, who has an application in England to pursue research of a similar kind, only using eggs from rabbits rather than human women because of the safety problems involved in that. We're talking now with Ruth Hubbard, who is at Professor Emeritus at Harvard and Emeritus Board Member of the Council for Responsible Genetics, speaking on her own behalf. And Professor Hubbard, you were saying a moment ago that you're concerned because, unlike Britain, where this is all very carefully researched in the United States, regulated in the United States. It's much more a matter of private activity and market-driven science. What's wrong with that?
Well, the problem with it being so heavily market-driven is that it has been hyped especially much in this country, as well as in other countries, but much less in Britain because of the regulations there and because that's the only way they can do the work. In fact, when the Korean research proved to be fraudulent, one of the things that I found most disagreeable was that a U.S. competitor of theirs here in Massachusetts immediately said, oh, but the most tragic thing about this are all the people who are going to have to die because this work is being slowed. That's really, to me, the essential problem, that the results of this work have been hyped so that people who are ill with very severe diseases are being given the hope that in short order, if this work can go ahead, they will be able to be cured, when in fact, as Dr. Shaw pointed out, one is at the very beginning of this kind of work and has no idea, in fact, whether it will ever yield any results. And going to work with rabbits or other animal makes eminently good sense at this stage. And just waiting before one goes to women who are definitely put at risk by collecting eggs. And it's, to me, highly questionable whether they should ever, whether eggs should ever be collected for research if women want to produce eggs because of infertility problems. They should be told that this is a risky business, but they must be able to do that. But to do it for research does not seem the appropriate way to go.
And the risks to women, if they have to be stimulated, as Professor Shaw said, in order to produce more eggs, are what? Why is it dangerous?
Because it requires hyperstimulating the ovaries to produce more than the usual single egg, but to in it per cycle. And there is good evidence that this can cause the ovaries to fail completely, and there is some suggestion that it might induce cancer. These are very new techniques. We do not have any women in their 50s, 60s, 70s who have undergone these treatments. And so we're just playing in the dark. And the thought of trying to collect thousands and thousands of eggs from who knows how many women for research that really should be being done with animals in order to map out where we're going with it and whether there's any hope for it at all seems the wrong time, the wrong place, and has to do with the competitive atmosphere and with the hyping of this kind of research that's unfortunately of the nature of the beast in the United States, where there is no licensing, no federal supervision. It's all highly individualized and competitive.
When you're talking about animal research in this context, and I realize this is an oversimplification, as we just heard from Professor Shaw, but if, in fact, what is being done is the implantation of human cells in the embryos of, let's say, rabbits, what about what's often referred to, Dr. Hubbard, as the yuck factor? That just doesn't sound very good to a lot of people.
Well, I have trouble with yuck factors because I think in general one person's yuck factor is another person's life. I mean, people have yuck reactions to all kinds of things that are just part of the life of other people. So I don't lay much store by yuck factors, and I would argue strongly against going with gut reactions like this rather than trying to figure out whether it makes sense in the larger context.
Well, again, Ruth Hubbard is Professor Emerita at Harvard and Emeritus Board Member of the Council for Responsible Genetics, speaking on her own behalf on this program. Larry Goldstein is Professor of Cellular and Molecular Medicine at the University of California, San Diego. He was very much involved with Proposition 71, which passed in 2004 in California, authorizing the state to support stem cell research and to raise $3 billion for that purpose. Professor Goldstein, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
What do you have to say about what Ruth Hubbard raised as a major problem, illustrated by all the hype about the research done in Korea, about the market-driven nature of research here, the lack of federal restrictions in particular, and do you think that it's time for another look at that?
Boy, so that's a Gordian knot of questions you just asked.
Well, okay, unravel it.
Okay, so one issue is, should the federal government be involved in a responsible and progressive way? And the answer to that, of course, is yes. It's nuts that the federal government has laid down ideological restrictions on this whole field of research, and it is part of what has driven the scientists and the folks who hope that the scientists will find things that will help them to explore other alternatives, such as state involvement and private sector involvement. The second issue that you raised is this question of hype. And hype is a very difficult problem in some ways. So Professor Hubbard is right that it's terrible to promise somebody who has a devastating disease that you know for sure that if you do this research, you will find a cure for them in the short term. That's not responsible. And I think if you really look at what the scientists have said about this area of research, generally, though not always, I admit, but generally they've been pretty responsible about putting in cautions. The media doesn't always report the cautions, I'll say. And an interesting thing I've learned over the years as I've interacted with families of people who have these diseases, both on the political side of the house and on the scientific side, because I work on some of these disorders, is that on the one hand, they want you to be realistic. On the other hand, they do want you to give them some hope that there is an opportunity to perhaps do something. And so there's a fine line to be walked there between telling people, well, we just can't do anything for you, so give up, versus we think we might be able to do something for you, so hang in there. And it's a tough problem. I freely admit that.
What about overstating the matter to potential investors? You're looking for a lot of money here. And is that a problem? Is that in part the fruit of what Dr. Hubbard is talking about, that even if you want to have some sort of a positive spin on things, you can overstate it, particularly if you're trying to raise money?
Well, I think I would distinguish between overstating things in boardrooms to venture capitalists and potential investors, which I think in this area has been really a much smaller issue because there's not a huge amount of private investment. The research is really at a stage where it's early. And in general, in the United States, early stage research is funded by the federal government. And that's a good thing because it means that the fruits of that research are available to all. Now, when the federal government fails to fund an area adequately, as it has done with the area of human embryonic stem cells, you have a problem. And in California, the solution that the public in California took was to vote to invest a substantial amount of money over the next 10 years to move this area of research ahead.
Was there a certain amount of hyping, given the nature of campaigns in California, when that was on the ballot?
Well, I think that depending on who you ask, you'll get a different answer to that. And I think depending on who was interviewed on any given day about that ballot measure, there are people who probably overpromised. As somebody who was involved with the campaign, I myself tried to be very careful and very circumspect about what I said. And I think most of the scientists involved, and in fact, most of the patient advocates who were involved, were pretty careful about what they said. I think that where distortion sometimes happens is in the media reporting and then in people's recollection of what the media said. I mean, I think hype is more complicated. You're not going to see me standing in the public square and saying, if you give me $10 million, I'm going to have a cure for Lou Gehrig's disease in 3 years. I know better than that, and I won't do that. On the other hand, I might say, if you give me $10 million, I'm going to do everything I can to move the field of Lou Gehrig's disease research ahead. I think that there are opportunities of this, that, and the other type.
and I believe that this is an appropriate way forward, and that's what many of us said.
Larry Goldstein again, professor at University of California, San Diego, active in getting Prop 71 passed in California, raising $3 billion for this kind of research. I want to go back to Professor Chris Shaw at King's College London. He's still with us, and again, is his colleague, Dr. Ian Wilmot, who was the one who cloned Dolly the sheep. Was there, Professor, in England and everywhere else, as a result of that breakthrough, a great deal of hype? And has it been, as a result, has this kind of research, do you think, been simplified and misunderstood?
Well, I don't think you can hold Ian Wilmot and the production of Dolly the sheep as the core element to this particular quandary, which is the belief in stem cells. In fact, his research wasn't really about stem cells. It was about nuclear reprogramming and generating a new organism out of a single cell. And I don't think he foresaw any of this, the development of the field that's happened subsequently. And a lot of the fundamental stem cell biology work has happened after Ian's original work. So I think I'm defending him and saying that he's not directly responsible for this.
I didn't mean to blame him. I'm really talking about the reportage and and what was circulated generally.
No, I think the concerns that were raised at the time related to the cloning of human beings, and of course that's a completely different issue which we're not going to deal with here. I think Ian is particularly cautious in his public statements about what this work can hold, and I think most of us who are actually working at the patient end of the spectrum are very cautious as well. I am a clinician, and I see patients with Lou Gehrig's disease, and many of them have great hopes about stem cell biology, and much of my time is actually in some ways making those hopes a bit more realistic and managing some of those expectations.
Is the situation, as described by Professor Hubbard, do you think significantly better in Britain because there is this process of going to the government for permission to conduct this kind of research? Is it more controlled there than it is here?
I think it's a completely different situation. I think the fact that the government is regulating all these elements is crucially important. And indeed, it is illegal for women to be paid money to undergo stimulation to provide eggs, which, of course, is perfectly legal in the United States and was legal in Korea up until fairly recently. So I think it's a very different setting, and I'm pleased that the government regulates these things. And I think it's important that the government, through the HFEA, the Human Fertilization Embryology Authority, takes a reading of the public's view on these various matters. And one of the reasons that we open a dialogue, particularly with the press, is to see what the response is to the kind of experiments that we would like to perform. And I think that's one of the reasons to discuss using animal oocytes, is to try and tackle this yuck factor. Because I think people have visions of some sort of mutant creature that's half man, half rabbit. And in fact, within a matter of a few days, almost all the proteins in the cells in the dividing embryo are going to be human. In the nucleus that's transferred into that egg, there are 25,000 genes. The only genes remaining in the cells in the long term are a tiny, tiny number of mitochondrial genes in a separate part of the cell. So, you know, I think to think that it's a kind of a chimera or some sort of hybrid is not a realistic representation. It's 99.9% human and just 0.1% rabbit.
All right. Again, Chris Shaw at King's College London. Back to Ruth Hubbard at Harvard and the Council for Responsible Genetics, once again speaking on her own behalf. Are women now being paid for their eggs?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
It seems to vary, but as I say, since nothing is being regulated, it depends on who's collecting the eggs. This is in some situations they definitely are, and certainly that's also true for fertility purposes. I mean, you may be aware of the fact that only a few years ago advertisements were appearing in college campus newspapers asking for offering huge sums of money, tens, twenties, thirties of thousands of dollars for eggs of bright, athletic young women for fertility purposes, for fertility clinics. So who knows? That's the problem that we have in this country, that situations like this simply are not regulated properly.
Larry Goldstein, quickly back to you at UC San Diego. I assume you don't disagree with that. Do you think that there ought not to be the payment for women, bright and athletic or otherwise, for their eggs?
Well, you know, that's a complicated issue because I think one needs to be very precise about what's going on here. The fertility business has been paying women for their eggs for a long time, and as far as I know, will continue to do so, and nobody's actually proposed that that stop, at least in California.
Well, Professor Hubbard says that we don't have women in their 60s and so on who've had this kind of stimulation, once again, that was described as what's required. How do we know they're safe?
Fair enough, and it is true that no medical procedure is known to be safe in many cases for some time afterwards. But I want to distinguish the uses in fertility clinics from stem cell research, which I care a great deal more about, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to point out that California is in the place of putting in place a very strict regulatory system of the type that was recommended by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and in some ways similar to what exists in Britain. So in California, we're not just rushing willy-nilly ahead like a bunch of cowboys. We are in the process of putting strong regulatory systems in place so that people's interests are not abused. And I think, you know, Professor Hubbard and I would agree that that's an appropriate thing to do.
We'll find out. Professor, do you think that's true? Is it conceivable that California might set the model for the rest of the nation if, in fact, there's a change in federal policy?
Well, I think California is trying to do this, but as long as the research is privately funded, which I understand that in California there's tax money goes into that, but I do think that a unified government policy is what we really need, because important as California is, it's not the nation, and I think we need a complete new look and approach to this, and how to get it is another question.
We are going to leave it at that for the moment. We'll come back, revisit this very important issue of stem cell research in the future. Meantime, thanks to Ruth Hubbard, again at Harvard, from Harvard, and the Council for Responsible Genetics, Larry Goldstein at the University of California, San Diego, Professor Chris Shaw, King's College, London, and our earlier guest, Dr. Donald Kennedy, the current editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. Thanks to all of you for being with us. Dr. Martin Luther King Day is one of America's least observed holidays, perhaps because there's still controversy over his legacy and how his ideas should be applied in America almost 30 years after his death. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Borman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Two out of three companies don't give their employees time off on MLK Day. But all over the country, he is supported, not just by parades and dinners, but also by civic actions like feeding the hungry and registering voters. Congressman John Conyers, who helped create the holiday, says he's pleased that it hasn't deteriorated into another bargain day at the mall. Joe Hicks once headed the Los Angeles chapter of Dr. King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Since then, he was head of the Human Relations Commission for a Republican mayor in Los Angeles. He's now with a nonprofit group, Community Advocates, that works on race relations in this neighborhood. Joe Hicks, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
While you were with the Southern Christian Conference, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, you studied the work of Dr. Martin Luther King very carefully. And one of the things you concluded, as I remember from that, was that such things as affirmative action are really not part of what the doctor's legacy ought to be. Explain what you think his legacy is.
Well, I think his legacy clearly is one of directing this nation to some extremely pressing problems at an era when the nation was frankly changing. And his legacy, I think, should be remembered as the American leader, and I don't like to use this word, black leader, the American leader, you know, who certainly helped to organize this nation's resistance against the kind of things that had discriminated, frankly, and oppressed, one could use that term, black Americans for so long. And I think he's remembered because of the tenor of his leadership was one that wasn't rancorous. And I think it tended to raise the nation to be its best and called America to be its best. So his legacy is, I think, frankly, the style of leadership that we remember because it was an American leadership that I think distinguishes itself from much that often pass itself off as leadership.
Since his death, many people have said that the legacy, to use that term again, of discrimination and oppression, and of course going back to slavery, is such today that we ought to have affirmative action and give people a leg up who are still suffering from what happened in the past. Why are you opposed to that?
Well, I think the facts simply don't hold up when one talks about the current state of discrimination in this nation. I've argued, and I was once, as you know, Warren, a big supporter of affirmative action. I believed it was a good thing. Now looking back at it, I think that this path of race-based preferences was always a wrong thing. I think that what we should have done, and of course, it's Monday morning quarterbacking here, but had we made that kind of assistance for people who needed it based on class and economic status, perhaps, rather than skin color, it would not have caused the kind of difficulties we now find ourselves in. There's no reason, Warren, in today's America, to give people some preferences based on the color of their skin, because based on that, you can't help but discriminating against other Americans who don't, quote, have the right skin color. So I think it will be a problem in this nation until, as Justice O'Connor said, we phase it out, and she said within 25 years. I have trouble figuring what's special about that time frame, though.
Joe Hicks again, and now with the Community Advocates in Los Angeles. Dr. Earl Ofari Hutchinson's a nationally syndicated columnist. He's a radio host, a civil rights activist, author of several books, including The Crisis of Black and Black, and he joins us from his home in Los Angeles. Dr. Hutchinson, good to have you back at our program.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
Is this issue of affirmative action still a bone of contention in the black community in particular, although I think we want to take note of what Joe Hicks said about Dr. Hicks as an American leader, not just a black leader?
Certainly affirmative action is not only a bone of contention, but it's still a necessity. Even in 2006, we have preferences for a lot of things, not just based on skin color. A major debate at universities and colleges about legacy preferences, alumni preferences, athletic preferences. So there is a history where certain individuals, based on wealth, based on privilege, and yes, even based on skin color, where there are preferences for them, where they do get the proverbial leg up. I think where it breaks down is on the issue of color. Why is it always such a contentious issue? Why is it always such a divisive issue when we're talking about those that still, as we speak today, are still discriminated against, still, in fact, have a huge, huge a deficit in terms of equal opportunity in a lot of different areas? Why is it such a point of contention when we talk about not preferences, not even quotas, but essentially giving some nod, giving some recognition, giving some support, providing some resources for those that are still drastically disadvantaged based on skin color?
If I understand Joe Hicks correctly, he said that he thought that if you do that based on skin color, you can't help but discriminate against people who don't have that going for them. What do you say to that, and how do you reconcile his concerns?
Well, let's go back to Dr. King. Dr. King had some great answers to that. Even though affirmative action had not seeped into the national lexicon at that point, wasn't really on the radar scope during that time frame, in his last seminal work, probably his most comprehensive work, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, he talked about that extensively, about developing programs, special need programs for, in this case, the African-American disadvantaged and the poor. The fact that you do have this century-long or more legacy of discrimination, certainly racial injustice, oppressiveness, and economic disadvantage, it's unfair simply to say, okay, now you've got civil rights laws, now you've got a Voting Rights Act, now the barriers have come down, and certainly private industry and universities and colleges and within the political arena now compete on an equal plane. It's not fair.
Okay, Joe Hicks, back to you. What about it? Why is it fair?
Well, I think it's literally absurd to claim that in today's America that there's some cabal of white academics sitting around trying to figure out how to keep black students out of the university. That's not the problem. They're begging literally for qualified black students to come to university. My daughter right now is on her way to university. You should look at the reams of material in terms of them trying to recruit her. So it's not a problem of people keeping people out of the university. So this notion we need special preferences based on skin color to get kids into university is, I think, just frankly absurd.
Dr. Hutchinson, your response? We are running short of time.
Because the bottom line is you still have a huge, huge deficit, a huge, huge gap in terms of African American, particularly male students on college campus, university campuses today. And it's not just simply because you can't find qualified African Americans. There are some historical reasons for that and some contemporary reasons for it. And it tracks back into the lousy education, economic disadvantage, lack of skills, and lack of resources. So when you're talking about preferences, I think we need to get away from that. We need to talk about simply using the human capital, and in this case it happens to be African American human capital that's being wasted simply because we don't provide the support and resources to make sure they are competitive. There's nothing absurd about that.
A nuanced discussion between two people very much devoted to the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on this Martin Luther King Day. Thank you both, Dr. Earl Ofari Hutchinson and Joe Hicks, both here in Los Angeles. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Sharon Rembaum and Jonah King, Technical Director John Patrick Costello. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.